This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station Joy 94.9.
This week we have a queer scientist who we would like to introduce you to. Her name is Mary Mancilla. She is of a Filipino migrant background. She's lived in Australia since she was 3 years old. She has a Bachelor of Biomedical Sciences at an honours level and is currently doing her PhD at the Hudson Institute for Medical Research.
She was nominated and shortlisted for the Glen Iris Young Citizen of the Year Award for her work in mental health advocacy, and she's also worked for Headspace.
Mary identifies as bisexual. Her main scientific interest is in reproductive health, placental biology, and pregnancy-related disorders, and she is currently doing research into the causes of a particular pregnancy-related disorder called preeclampsia.
Yeah, and Nicholas sat down early this week with Mary, and this is what he learned from her.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. I'm very good.
Would you like to introduce me and the listeners to yourself? Mm-hmm. You told me that you were from a migrant background, so can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes. So I'm a 26-year-old female. I grew up in Australia, but my parents had moved here from the Philippines when I was 3 years old. So my parents had come from quite a low socioeconomic background. My mom had lived in poverty while we were in the Philippines. And the reason for them moving over to Australia was to give us a better life, to provide us with opportunities that weren't going to be available to us in the Philippines.
Coming from that background, what attracted you to science?
So my grandpa on my father's side, he was actually a surgeon. And he was really wonderful in just entwining so many medical facts into our upbringing. And this curiosity within me, and he was able to really feed into that. And so the mystery and also the amazement of the human body and how there's so much we still don't know, that always really interested me. And so as I continued on with my education, especially throughout high school and early university, that's when I really started to delve into science. For me especially, it was in the third year of my undergraduate degree where I finished a unit called fetal and neonatal development. It's the process of growing within the womb as you're going through pregnancy and how there are all these different changes that need to occur, both maternal and for the baby to grow, and just how intricate that process is and how there's still so much that we don't know about it, yet every single one of us here have gone through it. And so it was just really fascinating unknown for me to try to explore.
I identify as queer, yes. Specifically bisexual.
Yes,
how big of a part of your life is this for you?
Absolutely. This was a very big internal conflict growing up, coming from a migrant background where in my culture, any sexuality that deviates from heteronormativity isn't well accepted, and it isn't well spoken about. I grew up as a really devout Catholic, and so I was at really strong odds with my sexuality and also my religious beliefs at the time. And so growing up, that was, you know, a really intense emotional journey that I had to go through, but also no one in my family or no one I had known in my community identified as queer. And so feeling alone in that space, as a young person was awful. It was horrible. And so what I didn't know at the time was that my eldest brother actually identified as queer. But he had never spoken about it until much later on in our upbringing. And that in itself was a huge, huge relief for me because I found an ally so close to me. And I respected him so much. I loved him so much and still do. And I think he was the very first point where I started to feel comfortable in myself because I saw how comfortable he was in his self.
Have you met many queer people in science in Melbourne?
Not at the beginning, no. I also recognize I hadn't sought that space. Part of it because I didn't know it existed. And that was part of the problem. Later on in my academic journey, especially throughout this PhD I have now, and I recognize just how powerful that is to feel like I have this sub-community within this academic field where I feel like I truly belong. And it's been so empowering to meet all of these queer scientists who are incredible, who are inspiring, who are powerful, and who have all really unique stories that help shape who they are.
You also identified as somebody who's living with a mental health disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Are you comfortable talking about this?
Yes, absolutely. Yep. So in my second year of my undergraduate degree, I was hospitalized for about 6 months, suffering from major depressive disorder and generalized anxiety disorder. And so during this time period, this was my first and my most intense episode of mental illness. But it was also a really big chapter of my life, recognizing just how prevalent mental illness is in my family in terms of a biological aspect, but also recognizing how little we speak about mental illness in our culture, and how poorly that is translated into how we behave and how we communicate about things like mental illness. And so it was this big transition of understanding where my brain was going, but also how I could combat this with medication, with therapy, with social supports, because it really took a village to recover from that. And I think I am a very big mental health advocate now. I am involved with a whole host of youth mental health organizations, and especially in academia, where academics have a higher rate of mental illness compared to the general population. I think it's definitely something that I still speak about because it's so important, it's so prevalent, and it's definitely something I still continue to manage every single day. I think recovery isn't a linear process, and certainly my recovery hasn't been. And so every day is a new challenge, and luckily now I have the tools and also the networks to help me go through that journey. I think it's also quite difficult because I do identify in so many different minorities, and all of these minorities have a greater risk of poor mental health, poor physical health, poor opportunities throughout their lifetime. And so it's hard to pin down exactly where my sexuality had fit into that, but I definitely do think it played a role. And I think part of that is feeling like I don't connect with my community. Feeling that hesitance of, you know, whether to share my sexuality. Because I think coming out is a continuous process. Mm-hmm. It happens every single time. It happens when you want to bring your partner to a certain work event, whether, you know, another PhD student or another colleague will ask whether you're in a relationship. You're constantly coming out. And, it is a taxing process sometimes.
What would you describe as your area of expertise?
I would say reproductive health and placental biology.
It is so complicated, the process of turning a cell into a human being. Mm-hmm. So give us just some of your favorite things about, like, placental biology and, like, what fascinates you most?
So I always say that my favorite superhero is the placenta. The placenta it's this incredible organ, and it acts as the lungs, the kidneys, the gut for the growing baby. And it only exists for the baby. So once the pregnancy's finished, the placenta is also delivered and no longer exists in the mother. And so for 9 months, this placenta is responsible for a whole host of things, to nurture the baby and also to ensure that its survival is optimal even after it's born.
Something that sort of popped into my mind is, like, the idea of, like, the first breath of a baby after it exits the womb. How much of, like, a transitory process is that, going from getting your oxygen delivered by a placenta to breathing in your oxygen and intaking it with your own lungs?
That is such a vital and very necessary progress and process. And that's the thing. A healthy placenta often delivers a healthy baby. And so if you have an unhealthy placenta, that baby can then result in underdeveloped lungs. And that deprivation of oxygen can then result in a whole host of severe complications for the baby. So coming back to ensuring that that placenta is healthy can then really set up that baby for a healthy life and a healthy ability to take their first breath in a really easy way.
What kind of factors contribute to the health of a placenta?
Yeah, so outside factors, as you mentioned, diet, exercise, age. We're finding things in research about ethnicity and where you're coming from, but also smoking status is obviously something that's really big. There's new research coming out depending on what medications you're taking. Mm-hmm. But things that the mother can't always quite control is her own genetics, whether you are already at greater risk of, say, high cholesterol, high blood pressure. Those things will also affect the health and development of the placenta. And so then it becomes a management sort of risk. But BMI is also a very big contributing factor to the health and development of your placenta and also your overall pregnancy. It's definitely something that can be affected by so many varying things, and it's really hard to pinpoint which one is the most important. And so it just becomes, you know, your overall health is the utmost important thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Seems like every time I talk to a scientist or a doctor, they tell me smoking is bad.
Who
would have known?
Yes. Smoking and alcohol throughout pregnancy, just don't do it.
So tell me about your PhD project.
Mm-hmm. I'm at the Hudson Institute of Medical Research, and I'm with Professor Guing Ni. She is a placental biology expert. She is one of my heroes. She is one of the very few women in STEM who are also culturally and linguistically diverse in this institute. So that was also really helpful in me deciding which team that I wanted to go in. And luckily for me, my research team are also all women in STEM. So that's also been very fantastic. Yeah. So I've been with this team since 2016. So I completed my honors project then, which was also about the development of the very outer layer of the placenta. And then as I'd finished that, I decided that I was really passionate about this project and I was really passionate about this team. And so I then started my PhD project, which is about a 3.5-year undertaking. It's like an honors degree, but you multiply that by, 3 years. And it's essentially on the same project. So it's about the formation of that outer layer of the placenta. And so that outer layer is responsible for the transference of oxygen, nutrients, and waste products between the mother's blood and the fetal blood. So if this layer is impaired, then that means the oxygen transfer, the waste transfer, all of that is then disrupted. And what happens then is that it can cause havoc for both mom and baby. So we're looking at why this happens, and how we can then predict whether this will happen, and then how we can be able to treat it when it does happen, because it can cause severe complications. And in developing worlds, it does result in a really high mortality and morbidity rate. Worldwide, it's about accounting for 10 to 11% of all pregnancies. So of all pregnancies. So that then results in, I think it's over 500,000 neonatal deaths per year. So almost 500,000 babies dying per year from preeclampsia. In developing worlds, they don't have the intensive care units to take care of babies who are born so prematurely. These babies require round-the-clock care, really specialized care, certain methods, certain treatments that aren't always accessible there. And so a lot of the time in these developing worlds, they don't survive. Luckily, in the Western world, and especially in Australia, the mortality and morbidity rate for preeclampsia is quite low, because these babies are still being born quite early, even as early as 26 weeks. But we do have the facilities and the research teams and specialized teams to carry these babies so that they can, reach full development age and be okay.
What are the areas that you're investigating to see what the cause of this is?
So the problem with the treatment of preeclampsia is that there is no treatment. The only cure is delivery of the placenta, which also means delivery of the baby, because one can't survive without the other. And so the current treatment route now is management, trying to manage mom's health so that she can keep in the baby for as long as she can. But part of the problem is that we also can't predict who will have preeclampsia yet. You can be at higher risk, and there's a whole reasons why you're at higher risk, but we don't definitively have a test to know whether or not you will be someone who delivers it. And so that is a huge difficulty in maternal healthcare, because that then suggests that everyone could be at risk. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to investigate certain factors that exist and are being produced by the placenta, and to see whether these factors are a direct result of the impaired placenta. So our lab in particular, we're looking at one certain factor that is produced and released by the placenta, and it's only seen in significantly higher levels in preeclampsia. No other pregnancy-related disorder, and it's only produced by the placenta. So it's very organ-specific. And so we're trying to understand whether this one factor is responsible or is a driving factor or a critical factor to the development of this disease.
I feel like I'm about to open the floodgates to a whole lot of jargon, yeah. But can you tell me about it?
Yes. So it's called high temperature requirement factor A4. Yes. Essentially, it is it's a stress factor, and that's the thing. We don't exactly know how it's involved with this disorder and why it's produced in such high levels in this pregnancy disorder. But it's a new factor that our lab has been investigating for not very long, actually. But it's a very exciting field of research. And we're just trying to figure out why is this produced at higher levels only in this pregnancy-related disorder? And how does it then come into play on how critical is it for placental development? And how critical is it if the levels aren't quite right?
So it's a stress factor. Is its exact role known?
No.
Oh, okay.
And that's what we're trying to figure out, the mechanisms.
So it might be, it could potentially go both ways, perhaps, where too much of it is bad or too much of it is a response to whatever else is wrong.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And so it may not be the root cause of this pregnancy disorder. That's the thing with preeclampsia. It's a multifactorial disorder. And so there may not be just one cause for this. But the fact that it is increased at such high levels by the placenta and only by the placenta in these pregnancy-related disorders, it's a really interesting field to try and explore.
A strong correlation. Is there anything else that you'd want to say or explain around this research? Or we could go into just, a couple of fun questions about developmental biology to finish off.
Yeah, sure. Hit me with your fun questions.
Oh, okay. just because this is going out on Joy, the queer station, I wanted to ask, is there much research into trans male pregnancy, men who were assigned female at birth transition, they still have, a womb. They still have the capacity to get pregnant and to give birth to children. How much knowledge do we have in this area?
To my knowledge, not very much. In the research literature that I have looked at, I don't think I've come across any published articles of that.
Are there any like major known differences in how trans men versus cis women like experience pregnancy, childbirth, etc.?
Not to my knowledge, no, but I'd imagine it would be a vastly different system. And part of that is the hormonal interplay. So pregnancy is so driven by hormones. And they all must occur at certain levels and at certain ratios. I would imagine that would be a very different system. But I don't think there is a lot of research that is going into this space at the moment.
Could be something for one of the future scientists listening to this.
Absolutely. That is really important.
And one last question just for myself, because I am a cesarean. I've heard several times from several conservative family members that apparently cesareans didn't learn to fight like properly birthed people did.
I see.
And so they have less energy and, several explanations later, something to do with vaccines, that's why you're gay. Is there any scientific basis for cesarean birthed babies not learning to fight properly?
I disagree with that. No.
Okay.
I do not believe that there is research to show that cesarean birth is related to a person's ability to fight or their sexual identity.
Are there any like appreciable differences between a baby who is delivered via cesarean and a baby who is delivered naturally?
The research is still very conflicted in that space. I'm not well versed in that, though the research that I do know is the differences between babies who are breastfed versus babies who are bottle fed, and the developmental changes that exist there. But yeah, I don't know too much about babies who are C-section versus babies who are natural birth. But at the same time, I think in the world that we live in now, a lot of the differences that do occur so early on in developmental stages, they don't have as great of an impact as they once did, just because of the advances that we've made. And I think also the reasonings for C-section are often quite valid, whether they put the mother at risk to have to deliver naturally. And so there's a whole host of reasons. And so I wouldn't discourage anyone from one or the other in fear of, you know, myths.
I think we've reached a good spot to end the interview. Is there any last final thing you'd like to say to our audience?
No, I'm so grateful to have this opportunity. So thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.